the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, those of you who were here last week, I've got the same cough. I've added to it a cold. Lemsip's great. So if I slightly lose track, that's where I'm coming from. And I've got this, so hopefully I won't be spluttering all the time down the microphone being recorded and things like this. Also, like last week, it's a really big topic to cover tonight, and there's no way I can do justice to it in the sort of 30 minutes that I've got going on. So we're going to look at aspects of this topic. Okay, part of it does link to last week. So if you weren't here last week, when it's online, you can download and listen to that. And that's talking about Christians and violence in terms of warfare. And particularly, that was looking at just war theory and pacifism. And that does cross over into this talk. So earlier, we've just heard from Tim about his willingness to break the law as a Christian because he disagreed with the government's point of view. Although his behaviour was certainly not as violent as some of the recent yellow jacket protests in France. So as Christians, should we see this sort of Christian behaviour, Christians who do this, should we see them as heroes or as villains? Should we see Christians who protest against the government as role models or rebels? And what punishment should they actually face? So that's our focus today. How much should the church leadership respond to Christians protesting? What should our leadership do in that situation? So I want us to use today our creative minds. I want us to do a bit of imagination going on here. I want you to imagine our leaders are in the lounge and they're discussing how should Christians respond to political disagreements. Now, Nick, he's in charge of programming and all the Bible stuff. So he starts the meeting saying that there are a number of verses in the New Testament which describe how Christians should relate to the state. There's 1 Timothy, there's Titus, there's 1 Peter. But he believes, like many people down through the centuries, that Romans 13 verses 1 to 7 are the verses that control this debate, the most important ones. So what does Romans 13, 1 to 7 actually say? How should we use it to understand what Christians should do in terms of interacting with political systems? So if you've got a green Bible, we're going to read it now. It's on page 1076 of the green Bibles. So we're going to start at verse 1. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For the rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right and you'll be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. So how are we going to use that text tonight? Nick claims, in our imagination, I haven't tested him on this, that a plain reading of the text clearly says this: Christians should submit to the ruling authorities since God has chosen them to reign. And if you rebel against God's servant, you may face the death penalty, as this is God's approved punishment. By submitting to the state, you're doing your God-given duty and will have a clean conscience. Paying your taxes is an example of how to submit. Now, if that's a fair summary, if Nick's got it right, then clearly Christians should allow the death penalty, and maybe we should be actively campaigning for it to come back. Christians should submit to every government in power, no matter their laws. No protesting of any kind is allowed. Christians have to accept the political leaders and situations and circumstances they find themselves under. If Nick is correct. But in our imaginary meeting, Saz pipes up. She raises a query. Nick, are you sure this is what Paul intended when he wrote this passage? Was he seeking to create a timeless political theology which still applies in our lives today, in 2,000 years later, when we're living, and many people are living, not under the Roman Empire, but in a totally different political situation? Clive joins in. He wants to know that since it's such a short passage out of a much bigger letter, how does this passage fit in to the text, the full text? Does it match the overall message of Romans, perhaps? Adrian's keen, so he joins in as well. How does this passage fit in that whole overarching sweep of Scripture, the Bible? How does it fit into God's plans and purposes that are revealed throughout his word, what we sometimes call biblical theology? So the leadership are raising all these questions in the lounge, in the polite way, because they're Christians. But I'm sure they're quite raucous, their meeting. So Paul comes along, Paul in his calm way, his gentle way, and he says, maybe before we can decide what the book of Romans says in chapter 13, maybe we need to really look at the historical context of what was going on at Rome, in Rome. Maybe we need to look at the textual context. What was happening in that letter? What was Paul up to? How did Romans 13, 1 to 7 fit in with the rest of the letter? And what about that biblical content? How does that passage fit in the whole sweep of Scripture? And so, in the minutes I've got left, that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to explore those three themes. And we're just going to see whether Romans 13, or how much Romans 13 actually helps us understand a Christian's position in the world, whatever political state we're in. Is Romans 13 the key text? How helpful is it? It's been used for centuries to justify all sorts of things. It was used by people to justify not responding to apartheid by those in power, interestingly. Romans 13 is used to bring back the death penalty and to justify the death penalty by some people. So let's go through the historical context, the textual context, and the biblical context tonight. So let's start with the historical context. Moving from Apple through to PC today, the words have slightly moved around. We've got most of them sorted out, but there may be a couple of changes tonight. Worked fine last week, so I don't know why it didn't work this week. It's generally accepted that the book of Romans, the letter to the church in Rome, was written sort of around about maybe 57 AD, 56, 57, 58, possibly 59, not really earlier than about 56. And there's a number of reasons for that, but it's generally well accepted. It's that sort of late 50s, during a very interesting political time going on in Rome. So in 49, Emperor Claudius had thrown out all the Jews from Rome. Now, it wasn't the first time that the Jews had actually been told to leave. That had happened in 19 AD and also 41 AD. But this time, they were told to leave because they were disrupting normal life with heated arguments over somebody called Crestus. And most people believe that Crestus refers to Jesus Christ, and it's probably, there's a huge debate going on in the synagogues which were pouring out onto the street that was disrupting normal life in terms of the Jewish converts to Christianity arguing and debating with non-Christian Jews staying in the synagogues. Now, it may also be that not all the Jews left, but definitely the leaders of the Jewish communities, the wealthy Jews, were certainly forced out. So in 49 AD, Claudius removed all Jews. And then he was removed and replaced by Nero. Nero was only 16, and he had a number of helpers, shall we say, who guided him in what he did. But we may know Nero as quite a nasty piece of work, but actually his early years were relatively gentle. The first 5 years, he actually brought peace and calm to a certain extent to the Roman Empire, if not to Rome itself. We know that in 54 AD, he invited the Jews to come back. So the Jews had been absent for 5 years. And during that time, one can surmise that the Gentile church, that the church carried on with Gentile leaders rather than Jewish leaders. But he invited them back in 54 AD, and they came back to an interesting situation, because in Rome at the time, there were problems going on around the empire and in Rome. So over in Palestine, there was a big upsurge of Jewish nationalism, that the Jewish zealots were starting to campaign about their freedom again. But in Rome itself, there were huge complaints about the taxes that had to be paid. There were two types of Roman tax. The first one they were fine with. It was the second one. It was more to do with the VAT and tax on goods and trade. And it got to the extent where there were riots. So in 58 AD, we know that there were actually riots in the streets of Rome over the tax and people refusing to pay for it. It was quite violent. We know that Nero promised he was actually going to suspend the taxes totally. Interestingly, maybe a politician, he never delivered on his promise, but he did actually promise it. So that's the context of, or the background in terms of what's going on in Rome when Paul writes to the Christians in Rome. Paul's writing predominantly to a Gentile church as they welcome back their Jewish brothers and sisters who've converted to Christianity. Those Jews had been expelled for being disruptive, and they've been welcomed back to Rome, which is still being disrupted, but this time over taxation rather than religion. So I wonder if that context, that historical context, helps us to understand why Paul wrote what he did in Romans 13. Paul's message certainly tells the community of God to not draw attention to themselves, not to get involved in the tax riots, to present themselves as loyal citizens and not as rebels to the empire, where the Jews are rebelling. He tells them to be good citizens. God has given authority to the Roman state. Law-abiding citizens don't fear punishment. And what is that punishment they might fear? If you look at verse 4, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Now, this phrase is slightly odd. The bearer of the sword. It's slightly odd because the sword wasn't the standard means of execution for non-Romans. Crucifixion was. And even for Romans, the word here translated sword is generally means a short sword, that small sword there. And again, if you were executed, you weren't executed with the short sword. There's a different sword that you were executed with. So there's a bit of a debate over what punishment is being referred to here. Is this specifically referring to the state being able to give the death penalty and capital punishment? And there are many Christians who would accept that this is perhaps the key New Testament verse justifying capital punishment. But there are others who say it's definitely referring to punishment, but it's not automatically referring to the death penalty. It's referring to general punishment that can occur in the Roman world. We know that that all government officials on duty, they wore ceremonial swords, and the sword was a sign of their authority. They never used that sword. It was decorative. We also know that actually the tax collectors would have sword bearers with them. And there was a title given to the people who accompanied them to enforce the law. So the historical context doesn't seem to suggest automatically that political systems are allowed to use the death penalty, at least not this text. But this text does seem to suggest that maybe civil disobedience is not acceptable. So I wonder if we can run with those two thoughts and let's explore the next bit, which is the textual context. Perhaps it will give us more clarity. So, Romans 13, it sits right in the second half, if you like, of Romans. So if we look at Romans, you can sort of divide it. It's not a clear divide. I used nice posh words last week. Orthodoxy means right teaching or right thinking. And people say that chapters 1 to 11 in Romans is mainly theology. It's mainly big stuff. And that's probably true. Probably 80% of it, maybe 70% of it is that. There is some ethics in there as well, tucked in there. Okay, but fundamentally, the first part, and Paul does this in a number of his letters. He lays out the heavy stuff first. And then in part two, we have this flip into what I've called orthopraxy, because I've just learnt big words, which means right praxis, right doing, acting. So the first half of Romans is mainly right thinking, right theory, and the second half is right action. And this second half, Romans 12 through to 15, really, 16 is all the thank yous and everything at the end, is all about what should Christians do? And that's where we find Romans 13, 1 through to 7. Now, at that switch between chapter 11 and chapter 12, Paul helpfully puts in a little passage. Let me read it for you. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. So here is a call to live a different life with different values, a life where the people of God follow God's will, where they leave the old world behind and are transformed by understanding God's vision for his creation. Part two focuses on how to live that Christian life in the nitty-gritty. Now, last week, if you were here, I talked about Jesus' development, progression, extension of the Jewish law into that law of love. We used Matthew 22 and that expression when Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment? He says, love God and love your neighbor. Buy one, get one free. He doesn't separate out the worship of God and the ethics involved in that. And Paul emphasizes in chapters 12 and 13 this idea of love and its important role. And it's quite small, not too bad on the screen. So in verse 14, he says, bless those who persecute you. Live in harmony with each other, verse 16. Live at peace with everyone, verse 18. Do not seek revenge, verse 19. Feed your enemy, verse 20. And verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And that leads up to Romans 13, 1 to 7. And following it from verse 8 onwards in 13, it says, The Christians are called to love their neighbors. Love does not bring harm to others, verse 10. To behave decently as the end times approach, verse 13. So in chapters 12 and chapters 13, Paul presents a message of God's will is living a life of peace and love. Last week I talked about shalom and how shalom is more than just peace, calmness. It's about fulfillment. It's about satisfaction. It's about completeness. It's about being in relationship with God. It's about the time will come when the new heavens and the new earth arrive. And here Paul all the time is referring back to that. The Roman authorities, it seems to me, what Paul is saying, and not to be challenged, but instead loved. Paul himself has benefited from his Roman citizenship. and the stability that Roman rule has actually brought. He travelled around the Mediterranean fairly safely, the odd storm, etc. He was protected by the Romans against some Jewish behaviour. He used his citizenship to bring the gospel to people. And so it's interesting that we find Romans 1 to 7 in amongst this passage which is talking about loving the neighbour, even if the neighbour's an enemy. And I think structurally as well, what's really important is the example. Because the example fits in so well historically with what's going on with Rome at the time. The Jewish Christian traders, such as Aquila and Priscilla, they're mentioned in Romans 16, so they're back in Rome. But in Acts 18, Paul met them in Corinth. So they obviously had left. So these traders, and there would have been many more, one can surmise, Paul's telling them not to get mixed up in these riots about taxes on trade. So how does that leave our leaders discussing what should their attitude be to Christians who protest? We're not sure about the punishment that the state should give to people who break the law. The jury's out a little bit on whether the death penalty is a legitimate God-sanctioned punishment. There's debate on that. No clear cut. But from this text, it still seems that Romans 13 is still saying civil disobedience is wrong to submit. So when Christians engage in political action, what should our attitude be to them? Now, clearly, Tim was involved in a civil disobedience, but it wasn't over tax. Is Paul just writing about a particular situation in history? This is a situation based on what's going on in Rome at the time. And it's a tax riot. Or campaigning for the environment is not a tax issue, necessarily straight. No property was damaged, no people hurt. And I know Tim showed love and peace to the police that arrested him. But does Romans 13 allow us to challenge the authority of the state? And can we support our thoughts from other parts in Scripture? So let's go on and look at the biblical context. I'm going to discuss the death penalty relatively quickly and then move on to looking at civil disobedience. Romans 13 is actually the only major passage in the New Testament that could possibly support the death penalty. That explicitly, from that bearers of the sword. We have to go back into the Old Testament, and particularly Genesis 9 is probably the key text that is used as the foundation of any belief in the death penalty. If a state is allowed to use the death penalty from a Christian point of view, it's going to be this verse that if you read anything, it's going to come up. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God, as God made mankind. There are other texts. We can go into Exodus 21, 22, 23. We can go into Leviticus 20 and 24. They all allow or command executions in certain situations. But as I said last week, our understanding of how the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together is going to impact how you understand how commandments and codes from the Old Testament flow into the New Testament and outwards to us today. And that's part of the reason, as I said last week, why some Christians hold to a just war theory, that war is always bad, but it may be justified in very specific circumstances. That's a certain reading of this link between the Old Testament and New Testament. And pacifism, which believes that war is always bad, and if we go to the full view of pacifism, that conflict of any sort is never allowed by the Christian. Whether that's civil, in terms of Christians shouldn't join the police force, or whether that's in military terms. So that sort of absolutist viewpoint. And there's all sorts of positions along a spectrum. We talked about that last week. But when we're facing how do we apply the Bible to our lives in the 21st century, then we still have to have an idea of how does the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Old Covenant, the New Covenant, how does it fit together? And down through the centuries, there's been different models and different patterns. And that's primarily, I think, why a lot of Christians disagree. They have different understandings of how the Old Testament and the New Testament fit together. John Stott believed that Romans 13... amongst other passages, particularly in the Old Testament, did allow for the death penalty. We know that Article 37 of the Church of England's 39 Articles allows for the death penalty under certain circumstances. And up until 2018, the Roman Catholic Church also allowed for the death penalty. But very recently, like I said, in 2018, it actually changed its position. So, clearly, there may be grounds for some Christians to believe the death penalty is acceptable. But Romans 13 can be read in a different way. And if you look at the flow from Old Testament to New Testament, then actually some people would say the New Testament, in its reinterpretation, in its expansion of revelation from the Old Testament, with its transformation of the Old Testament, may actually disagree with that and say that the death penalty has come to an end. A new covenant, a new testimony, particularly following on from the Sermon on the Mount and beyond. Christians like behind me, Shane Claiborne, Stanley Haravas, they claim that forgiveness is a central feature of the new covenant. We no longer live under law, but under grace. We are no longer to seek an eye for an eye. And Jesus, interestingly, those words there, if you're familiar with them, the woman caught in adultery. Under Jewish law, if you're caught in adultery, you're meant to be stoned to death. But in John 8, Jesus declares, "Go now and leave your life of sin." So perhaps Christians are safe from the death penalty. Maybe it's inappropriate for Christians to campaign for it. In most countries of the world, it is gone. But it is still around in about 19. But we have to address the civil disobedience side as well. The Old Testament recognizes that God works through and with governments that may be Jewish governments or they may be non-Jewish governments. When we read the prophets, when we look back at the history of the people of God, foreign kings are used by God for his plans and his purposes. Invading nations are sometimes said to be acting as God's agents, judging the people of God, Israelite sins. But at the same time, there's clear evidence that the Israelites, who ignored the orders of governments, were viewed as people of great faith. Moses' parents, they didn't kill him. They put him in a basket. And the Hebrew midwives in Exodus 1, the chapter before, we read about Moses in Exodus 2, they refused to kill the children. For those of you who've been brought up in Sunday school, I'm sure Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel 3, they ignored King Nebuchadnezzar's commands. They refused to bow before the idol. And Daniel went into the lion's den in chapter 6 of the book of Daniel because he refused to follow the king's instructions. So it seems, when we look at the Old Testament, that there's a mixture going on. Sometimes the people of God follow the nations, the governments, and sometimes they don't. It seems to come down to when following God clashes with following the state, you're meant to choose follow God. But when there isn't a clash, you can carry on with the state. Some of the people I've mentioned are mentioned in Hebrews 11, being commended for their faith in standing against the nations. And what about the New Testament? There are political texts in the New Testament which call on Christians to live at peace, shalom, with the state, Titus 3. They're told in 1 Timothy to even pray for their leaders. But there are, interestingly, these two texts, 1 Peter 2 and Romans 13. And they're quite similar if we play around with the Greek a little bit. So look at 1 Peter 2. It's very similar, actually, to its layout to Romans 13. Show proper respect to everyone, love the family of believers, fear God, honour the emperor. And then when we come down to Romans 13, the word respect actually is a Greek word which means fear. But it's been translated in the NIV, respect. So give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If fear, then fear. If honour, then honour. So there's a parallelism, I think, going between that. And if we add in something else, so we honour the state's authority, but we fear God. That seems to be a little bit of a hierarchy. And it seems a very strong parallel to these words from Jesus, from Matthew 22, when he was questioned, about taxes. It's interesting, isn't it? Paul's writing about taxes, and he's using a structure that's a little bit linked to what Jesus was writing about taxes. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, but to God what is God's. Jesus and the other New Testament writers, I think, seem to be recognizing that the state should have a role in our lives. But God has ultimate authority. And I think this is what Paul's saying in Romans as well. A famous passage you might sometimes hear about this is Acts 5. That's when Peter and the other apostles say, we must obey God rather than human beings. I think it's a really good passage. They're talking actually to the Jewish leaders rather than the Roman leaders at the time. So maybe it has slightly different weighting. But again, once again, they're saying is our priority must always be God, not the state. If the state is acting against God, then God comes first. And so let's just wrap things up now. So at different times and places throughout the Bible, sometimes the people of God submit to the ruling authorities and sometimes they don't. They all prioritize God's will over the state's will, if there's a difference. And they are called to always act in love and to seek peace, shalom. I think Romans 13 is speaking to a particular situation and circumstance. I think there is a historical context that we can't deny. So where does that leave our leaders here in their little meeting? I wonder how Nick's feeling. Perhaps civil disobedience should be accepted and maybe even encouraged by the Belmont leadership. Oops, I'm going to be discussed next, I think. But for the right reasons, when the state is turning away from God's will, the violent protest of the Yellow Jackets is certainly not allowed, according to the texts that we've looked at tonight. But a loving concern for God's creation is allowed. Tim said that he wasn't sure whether he had done something right or not. He wasn't sure what God's will was in that situation. To totally destroy history, Luther had an interesting phrase, which was, love God and sin bravely. It's quite a complex phrase, that, and it was to do with his own historical context and what was happening at the time. But what Luther was trying to say was, sometimes you do actions and you're not sure whether it's God's will or not, but it's about stepping out in faith and trusting God in those circumstances. And I think the topic we've studied tonight, particularly for us in the West, I think, is a really important one. I think for those who are sitting in persecuted countries, what I've said tonight is quite trivial in a way. They're facing far more complex, difficult decisions than we are in our very comfortable Western world. But our society is becoming, I think, less and less tolerant. As I say to my students when I teach political philosophy, that liberalism is one of the least tolerant ideologies, because if you don't accept it, it doesn't like you. And I think Christian values are becoming less and less tolerated in society, that everybody has to agree with a preset formula of value to do with personal autonomy, freedom, choice. Now, if our society is becoming less tolerant to Christian values, then we're going to have to decide day in, day out, at some point, maybe in the coming weeks ahead, whether to submit to the ruling authorities or to submit to God. And I don't want to be trite about that, but I think it's true. These are questions that we're going to have to face. Whether we submit to the ruling authorities or we engage perhaps in civil disobedience, we are called to love our neighbours even as they're arresting us. Remember, Paul used his time in prison to witness for Jesus. And perhaps for some of us, that may be a reality we may face in the future. I've been through a really tough topic, relatively quick. Hopefully it scratched the surface. Hopefully it's helped you just to think about the historical context when we're looking at ethics. Biblical ethics is important. The textual context is really important when we look at texts. And also the biblical context is really important. And it helps to explain why Christians disagree on some of these really difficult issues. So I think it's appropriate that we just end, before I hand back, just with a short prayer to help us just reflect on this. So let's pray together. I'm subverting the Serenity Prayer from Niebuhr, that many of you may know. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we should not change, the courage to campaign to change the things we should, and the wisdom to know the difference this week and in the weeks ahead. Amen.